And on Monday's morning show, a look behind the scenes at Pixar with Lawrence Levy, who became chief financial officer of the company just before they released their groundbreaking feature film, Toy Story. Levy's fascinating memoir is called To Pixar and Beyond. Support comes from Carthage College, welcoming Saturday Night Live cast member Colin Jost and alum Jay Farrow Thursday evening, March 16th. For more information, go to carthage.edu. Supporting WGTD is the Metropolitan Opera, whose next high-definition simulcast is this Saturday, March 11th at 12 noon, Giuseppe Verdi's beautiful and poignant La Traviata, at the Renaissance Theater in Racine and movie theaters across the country. For more information, metopera.org. Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, presenting an all-opera program Saturday, March 18th at the Roma Lodge in Racine, featuring opera professionals with a 60-voice chorus and a taste of Italy. Tickets at Personal Touch Florists, online at choralartsonline.org or at the door.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning, I'm Jim McClure, your host this week, and we have, for lack of a better term, an open reporter's notebook for you. We have interviews that I conducted within the past several weeks on some very timely topics and timeless topics, starting off with, you can't get any more timely than the Geneva Theater, the downtown Lake Geneva Theater. Yes, that theater, the one that's been shuttered since 2010. Emphasize past tense, emphasize future, emphasize present. For as we air, it has been open for just over a week. And yes, you can see movies in downtown Lake Geneva once again. The man who is responsible for that is the owner, Shad Brennan, who did a similar theater concept in Burlington, and that has been a success for some time now, and he intends to do same in Lake Geneva. And always easier said and done with these matters, and that's where I begin questioning Shad as far as how often the success factor is very narrow for both the proposals, starting the construction, and then actually getting to completion. Well, he has. Shad, how the heck did you pull this off? Because it just seems to me that almost nobody does. It's always a dream that's passed from developer to developer that never quite happens or falls through.
Actually, I don't know how we pulled it off. it's been a lot of fun so far, and our grand opening. Well, not the grand opening, but soft opening was made even more exciting with a fire alarm that went off, and so the fire department was able to join us for our first movie too. So yeah, I just shake my head throughout, but each day we're cleaning up things a little more and figuring things out, and as the weeks pass here and we get to our grand opening, we should be fully set.
Your experience in Burlington is nothing to sneeze at. What are the kind of the metrics that say that's been a success?
The response there and the growth of the theater has been very strong. So it has been successful, and I really appreciate the community support. And we've seen that here, too, that just the support overall has been phenomenal. So many people are coming in and on Facebook and elsewhere just expressing how excited they are for the theater to open. And so that's very motivational and quite an honor that we can do this.
How important of it in this day and age is it to have a theater as part of a vibrant downtown?
I think it's extremely important. I mean, I'm probably a little biased, but it's very important. I recognize that the city felt the same way, and that's why the city itself got involved with the TIF money. And I know that there had been some controversy over that, and I certainly respect the other side of that issue. But I think I think it's very important for the community and the overall health, and just I think hopefully that we are a huge attraction for downtown and help with the other businesses and vice versa. So we're excited to be here.
Lake Geneva and the Geneva Lakes area is known for being a great place to go year-round, but it's tough for businesses to make it in the off-season. Did you kind of study that and say, no, we can keep going pretty well when it's not sailboat and beach time?
Summers we're very excited for with the influx of people, but, you know, as you said, Lake Geneva is becoming more of a year-round destination. We also work with the movie schedule, which is a year-round cycle, too. I mean, there are highs and lows of movie releases, but what's nice is it really offsets those times, too. So it really will be a year-round business.
And forgive me, this is going a little longer because I'm fascinated and impressed. I'll make this it for now. Oh. But what's your first thought, or maybe you haven't yet, that we just might pull this off? There's people here or whatever. What's your first sign that this idea is going to work?
Again, the excitement, the enthusiasm that we've seen from the community and so many comments and social media and people walking in the door, and that's just been very motivating. So, I think we'll pull it off. I think it's got huge potential, and we're excited to be here.
What is it about the county as a whole when you look at all that it has to offer? And, you know, it certainly extends a little into Burlington, but how is Walworth County an attraction to someone like you who is looking at investing in a new business?
It's huge. We see so much development and improvement in Walworth County that, I think Lake Geneva is a destination just as much as the county is. And so, you know, we've seen that impact in Burlington, too, and it really is in the three-county area. Just a lot of growth and positive things that are happening that it benefits all the businesses, not just us, obviously, but everybody. Well, the theater has been converted back to four screens. The balcony is our screen number two, actually, but that gives us four auditoriums overall. The main auditorium is the largest at over 200 seats. There are over 500 seats overall between all four screens. But the main auditorium features a retractable screen, so with a remote control, we can lift that screen, and it reveals the 1928 stage that we'll use for live performances, too. So it's going to be just a very exciting addition to, you know, what this venue has to offer. It just opens the doors to so many other opportunities. All the theaters have 4K digital projection. We have 7.1 surround sound. It's all leather seating, recliners and rockers, and some additional plush leather seats, too, with tables in all the auditoriums. So we will have food service on the weekends. That may grow even to a week-long type feature that we'll offer. That's partnering with Sprecher's, so we'll have initially six of their food items available. So you just order that at concessions, and during the movie, we'll serve it to you. Again, there are tables in certain rows in each auditorium, and then trays that will fit into the cup holders so you can eat right at your seat. We do have beer and wine available, and our concessions is enhanced with ovens and other equipment, so we will be able to serve fresh pizza, sandwiches, and other items that are a little bit beyond a normal theater concessions offerings.
Talked, Shad, about acceptance of the community. Things like community theater, which Lake Geneva really doesn't have. Could this become a home for community theater, live radio presentations? You know, my station does live on-air radio. Are these the kind of things that could be held here as well?
Yes, we're extremely interested in those partnerships. I think it could run the gamut, and hopefully it does, of the type of entertainment that can be here, whether that's live music, theater performances, what have you. We're partnering with the Friends of the Geneva Theater, who had initial plans to develop this into an arts center. So by partnering with them, we hope to carry out a lot of their dreams for the facility, too. So because of that retractable screen, it opens up the door to so many other opportunities.
If you were to take a time machine back to 1928, what was happening on that stage when this opened? Was it vaudeville? Was it, who knows? Do you have any idea?
No, I certainly read up on the history, and we've tried to replicate as much of it historically in the theater itself, especially the main auditorium. So I don't know specifically what was being, you know, the stage was utilized at the time, primarily vaudeville, as I understand. But we spent a lot of time, and that's really what took so much time in remodeling of the theater was the ceiling to, you know, recondition the ceiling, some of the original artwork that was on the walls, and trying to revive that, restore that as it was.
We'll end on this note. A saying from vaudeville is always leave them wanting more. There's more to come here, isn't there?
We certainly hope so. We certainly hope so. This is just the beginning, we hope.
Well, if always leave them wanting more is part of show business, it's a little bit of what's going on with the Friends of the Geneva Theater. They wanted a little bit more for the final purpose of the theater, and they may get it in time. But I'm also happy to have on Community Matters today Janelle Powers, who was part of the a group that initially tried to save the theater. Their proposal didn't work out, but as the situation has worked out, they have teamed together, as Shad mentioned, to help support this new venture. And Janelle Powers is arguably the First Lady of Geneva Lakes Theater. She has acted in plays throughout the Midwest in Chicago, a very accomplished actress, very accomplished director, recently directing Fiddler on the Roof at a venue here in the Lake Geneva area, Chapel on the Hill, and is also the widow of John Powers, the author of some of the various famous books like Do Black Patent Leather Shoes Really Reflect Up? She is very witty. She's also a member of the 91.1 Players here on WGTD. In the past has done radio plays, stage plays, you name it. And Janelle, we welcome you to Community Matters. And would like to hear you weigh in on just how your part of the preservation all started.
In 2010, when the theater was closed, I approached a friend of mine, Elizabeth Chapel, and we decided to band together and try to purchase the theater for my professional theater company, Pelagia Productions, and her art museum, the Lake Geneva Art Museum. We tried for a long time. Unfortunately, we're never able to raise enough money to actually purchase the building. So ultimately, Shad purchased it, and it will be a very nice movie theater, I'm sure. But of course, Elizabeth and I had hoped that it would have become a community art center and an art museum and a place that our community could come and meet and have events at. I'm hoping that in time, Shad will also open it to the community. The Friends of the Geneva Theater, the group that Elizabeth and I started back in 2010, did donate a sizable amount of money to Shad in order to purchase curtains and some basic lighting, stage lighting, so that it could become an adequate performance venue.
Why, in your view, Janelle, with your years in theater experience here in Lake Geneva and in professional venues, why does Lake Geneva need that kind of community center presence?
We're a large enough community that it merits such a thing. If you go to Elkhorn, they have one. The fact that Lake Geneva doesn't is kind of a surprise. We have no place in town where events can happen. No stage, no. There's the high school, of course, but something like a community center would be something we really need.
And for listeners of this station, which goes all the way from between Milwaukee and the North Shore of Chicago, describe the artistic community that's in and around Lake Geneva, the kind of people you have here that would benefit from such a facility.
Well, we have an amazing community of artists, for one thing, and I think most people know that. But, you know, we're a tourist area, and to not have this kind of a venue that could have professional concerts and professional theater, when I was doing all of the more than a dozen productions, professional productions that I did at that theater prior to its closing in 2010, it was an amazing resource for tourists who came and wanted to see a show. Or when they come, they'll say, well, what do we do tonight? Now the beach is closed, it's dark, and, well, what's there to do in Lake Geneva? Not a lot. You can go to a movie, but they can do that at home. Or they go to the restaurants, or they go to the bars. But when I offered all of those productions that I offered over the years, they were very well received by not only the local community, but by the tourists. It could have been a very important venue for the area. And, of course, having a movie theater back in town right here on Broad Street, that's wonderful. Wonderful. But I was hoping for more.
And thank you, Janelle Powers. And we move now to Williams Bay on top of Yerkes Observatory, where in a classroom I met with Richard Dreiser, the tour director emeritus. His voice is very familiar to you, no doubt, if you've ever been on a tour or called the facility. And Richard and I talked about a number of topics while in a classroom at Yerkes recently.
Nobody really wanted to go to the moon, but there was this thing called the Cold War, which got everybody interested. And by the way, made education in the United States great again. We need another Cold War to make education neat, because
we seem well on the way.
Maybe. So, Gerard Kuiper hired undergraduates. He was apparently a difficult person to work with. He was apparently rather rude, but it doesn't matter. He was a former director of Yerkes. He was interested in going to the moon at a time when sensible astronomers were interested in answering questions like, how do galaxies form? And how big is the universe? They cared very little about the motes of dust, including asteroids and planets and the moon. So what Kuiper did was establish great maps of the moon, which were definitely used by NASA for the rangers which landed on the moon. I think maybe 2 of the 10 or so rangers actually worked. In one case, the camera stopped working. In another case, they crashed. We don't know. I don't know what happened. But it's just amazing. I think the movie about it is called Desert Moon. But don't quote me on that. Mm-hmm. So NASA really used these wonderful maps. And then when they actually had a ranger that had landed on the moon, they went back to Kuiper and said, we're going to land a man nearby, and we need to know exactly where it landed. So his grad students and he had to figure out, and did. So the lander landed probably 300 yards away from it on purpose.
Huh. Now, the rangers were early 60s, weren't they, before Surveyor?
The Rangers were early 60s, and I misspoke. The Rangers crashed into the moon, but the first landers, Surveyors, some of those absolutely worked. And by using photographs of where they were, looking horizontally, Kuiper and his students could figure out exactly where they were on the moon and told NASA about it. So NASA eventually could land one of the landers there. I don't think it was Apollo 17. Now, Apollo 17 happened.
Apollo 12.
Well, I'm talking 17, which was Cernan's last.
And I'm talking Apollo 12, which landed and said, hey, here's a Surveyor. Let's go take a picture with it. And they did.
You're right about that. That was Apollo 12. Gene Cernan was...
I'm right about most things. I thought I was, except once I thought I was wrong, and it turned out I was right.
Oh, Shirley, you jest.
Don't jest, and don't call me Shirley.
Fine. So, when Cernan got to the moon, I was at an awkward age. I was 21 in a few months. So I was too old to become an astronaut, and perhaps not as excited as I ought to have been. After all, going to the moon by then was rather ho-hum. But it was a great achievement, and Cernan was completely correct when he came to the realization that we might not go back, and we haven't, which is a pity. But on that same Apollo 17 mission, something extraordinary happened. A professional geologist went with Cernan. Yes, Harrison Schmitt, better known as Jack Schmitt, went to the moon, a certifiable geologist. Well, certified. Anyway, so he did things that you might not be able to do. Would you recognize an interesting rock here in southern Wisconsin? Maybe, maybe not. Anyway, Schmitt is one of my heroes.
And lest anyone say otherwise, this proves that you do, in fact, know Jack Schmitt.
I'm sorry you said that, and can only hope that it will be cut out eventually. This is a family program.
It is a family program. All right.
So the other thing was one of the most important people dealing with impact cratering, of which I have no small knowledge of, was Eugene Shoemaker. And Eugene, but for a heart problem, would have been an astronaut, almost certainly. And it was he who taught the astronauts, who were not geologists. Mm-hmm. They were test pilots, mostly, in the beginning, right? It was he who taught them about geology. So when they got to the moon, they wouldn't just say, ah, here's another rock. Hey, look, there's another rock over there. They learned to realize, is that a piece of volcanic lava? Or is it melt glass? Or is it sometimes a meteorite that's just lying around?
Mr. Shoemaker, of whom you speak, does he have a connection here?
Shoemaker does not, no. Okay. But there was a tight little community in the American Southwest, and everybody knows everybody. Eugene Shoemaker and his wife were great friends of a former director, Richard Crone's, late parents. And unfortunately, Shoemaker died while ferreting out meteorite impact craters in Australia. He apparently had an auto accident.
We've never had any Apollo astronauts come through here, have we?
Well, none. I know of no Apollo astronauts ever to come through here, although a University of Chicago, it's not just the former president of the United States anymore. His name is Barack Obama, by the way. A University of Chicago professor. It's not just him, but John Grunsfeld was a University of Chicago astronaut. He just retired from NASA, and he graduated from the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. He was on 5 of the 7 Hubble servicing missions, for example.
And took a little bit of Yerkes up there and back, did he not?
He did indeed. He took some information. He took a facsimile of Edwin P. Hubble's thesis, and he took some photographs and brought them up on the shuttle, went around the Earth 100 times or something, brought him back down to honor Hubble. And part of a microscope, which has been mislabeled for years as an eyepiece. It pretty much does the same things, but sometimes astronomers want to look very closely at a glass plate with stars on it. And so they will use a microscope to make it look bigger. And what was taken with him on one of the shuttle missions was thought to be an eyepiece used by Edwin P. Hubble, which turns out to have been a slight exaggeration by a former colleague of mine who was an engineer here and who said, oh, yeah, Hubble probably used this, and everyone believed it. The exhibit is no longer on exhibit, by the way.
Oh, so the picture of Grunsfeld with his eyepiece?
Grunsfeld is up there, but the eyepiece, which had been in a wonderful Lucite box in a beautiful stained oak stand, mm-hmm. is now missing, presumed dead.
All right. Well, I think we pretty well exhausted Mr. Cernan, if not ourselves. Tell me your anecdote about how Cobb built the place so that every year you had your offices, you had your three whatever. This is something we haven't heard before about how he designed the offices and the extra thingies.
I appear to be the only existent person at Yerkes Observatory, or in the world for that matter, who seems to care about the architectural detail. I would have by now, since I came here in 1980, been through all the archives and looked at everything Henry Ives Cobb wrote about the place. But Henry Ives Cobb was rather mysterious. Before dying, according to his eldest son, asked his eldest son to make sure all his papers were destroyed as soon as he was dead. And apparently, since we can't find any drawings and we can't find any notes and we can't find any detailed descriptions, we must imagine that, unfortunately, his son, rather than doing the smart thing, putting them away for 100 years, destroyed them. That would have been volumes of material. After all, Henry Ives Cobb did the Chicago Athletic Club. He did the old Chicago Historical Society building. Those are both sort of Romanesque revival, more or less. He did Newbery Library in Chicago. And he's perhaps most famous for doing the University of Chicago in German Gothic style, so that the new university established in 1890 by John D. Rockefeller would be taken seriously. You don't want to build it looking like Beaux-Arts style.
Right.
That would be silly. Yeah, it looks dark and, well, not dark. It looks gray and like an ancient cathedral or Oxford or Cambridge University. And the ploy seems to have worked. It is still among the top 10 best places to go for graduate studies.
From your halcyon years, working for Mr. Dr. Fujita, till your eyes were crossed, till coming here in 1980, have you seen that which I know as the legendary University of Chicago cerebral dry humor? I'm thinking specifically of Spider-Man, who's no longer with us, but tell us the story of Spider-Man.
Okay. For your information, the University of Chicago has no sense of humor. Actually, Spider-Man was originally an inflatable Spider-Man that I put, just at the very edge of the dome, as far as I could get, on a short ladder, within the dome on the inside. A prankster took it all the way to the very top and tied it up so that he couldn't be easily removed. Eventually, the original Spider-Man fell down and had been replaced by about a 5-foot-high inflatable Spider-Man I purchased on eBay. So I have nothing to do with him getting to the very top of the interior of the dome. One day, Dan Kaler, who now runs tours and sales, and I were working in the dome testing a microphone. He was standing roughly in the center of the dome. No, I was standing in the center of the dome with a microphone. One of us was standing in the center, and the other was talking into the microphone. And I saw Spider-Man suddenly, with the shutters open, it had been a windy day, suddenly break free of the mooring and rather float down, not so much floating, but not like a rock falling, and land right behind Dan with a whoosh. He was covered with bird poop. We did save him. I believe he is still downstairs now, hidden in one of the laboratories.
How long did Spider-Man exist in one form or another?
I think Spider-Man was up there a good 12 years, and I miss him.
We've been recording for 18 minutes, as I can tell. We've achieved only two 90-second segments, but we've got Gene Cernan doing something. We've talked a little bit about Ives. We've covered Spider-Man, so that's good. What else do you have up your sleeve?
I have the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, an actual plate by an organization that has the largest database of astrophysical information in the known universe. And what they intended to do was photograph the entire northern hemisphere of stars. And they did so with a specially equipped 2.5-meter diameter telescope located in a better spot than southern Wisconsin, on a mountaintop near Sunspot, New Mexico. That telescope would project an image as large as a hula hoop onto a metal plate from which they had drilled tiny holes, hundreds of them. And each hole corresponded to where the image of a distant galaxy would actually fall, leading down from the metal plates, each one overlapping the next, covering the entire northern hemisphere, would be an almost spaghetti-like strand leading to a spectrograph. So you could immediately tell for each galaxy what its redshift was and determine its distance in three dimensions. I just happen to have a metal plate from one right here. Mm-hmm. This is about as big as a hula hoop. We'll bong it for you.
Yeah.
This metal plate has hundreds of holes, again, most of them corresponding to actual galaxies, which look fuzzy on your picture, mm-hmm. as opposed to a star, which would be a sharp pinpoint. There are a few stars there, but the point is, each section of 8 or 12 galaxies has a freehand circle drawn around it. The spaghetti-like fiber optics would lead out from each, and they'd know exactly that one of them went to this particular hole or that particular hole.
Hmm.
And the whole process allows you to get redshifts of hundreds of galaxies at once. Compare this to Edwin P. Hubble, mm-hmm. who aimed telescopes larger than the Great Refractor at a single galaxy to get redshift of that particular galaxy. Well, these things have about $8 worth of aluminum in them, and I believe some of them were recycled. And then somebody smarter than I said, hey, let's use them for education outreach. Each one of these metal plates used for education outreach comes with two posters, which are the photograph of all those thousands of galaxies. We've done something recent that's very interesting, I hope. We didn't do it. But about 23 years ago, we had an undergrad for the summer here who looked as if he were 12 years old. His name, Christopher Consolis. He had come from Florida. He had never been west of the Mississippi. One day I said, Chris, jump in my car. We drove west of the Mississippi, looked around, drove back. So now he can say he's been west of the Mississippi. Well, Chris, in 23 years, still looks, well, maybe he looks like he's 14 now, but he has a little wispy goatee. He's married and has twin girls. But just last October of 2016, he was the principal investigator of a paper published in the Astrophysical Journal that indicates the universe is 10 times larger than anybody thought. We used to say there are 100 billion galaxies. Now we're going into the trillions. So that's pretty amazing for a kid who looked like he was 12 years old, who had never been west of the Mississippi.
What's the goofiest thing that's ever happened to you on a tour?
What's the goofiest thing that's ever happened to me during a tour? That's a hard one to answer.
If it doesn't come to mind, it's not worth asking.
I guess not. Although, the most romantic thing.
Well, what happened 2 days ago?
2 days ago, one of the tourists here said, oh, by the way, I'm supposed to ask you about Nibiru. And I said, you've been to Geneva Java Coffee Shop and run into my friend Jim Strauss. She said, yes, he said it would push your buttons and get you angry. And I refused to get angry. Nibiru, you know, Planet X. It's going to hit Earth and we're all going to die 20 years ago. Hey, it missed or something.
Hmm.
Yes, but that wasn't that funny.
No.
No.
You have a singular wit, sir.
What do you mean? So,
most romantic moment. All these people you've seen come through, what was the most interesting, or what do you recall of all these thousands of people you've seen? Do you have an anecdote of someone whose pants dropped, or someone who, a little kid who ran out and smashed his ice cream cone into the eyepiece, or?
I have no recollection of that, Senator. However, there is the story of the woman who came to the telescope and for reasons unknown to science, it was upside down with the lenses pointing down. And she said to the tour guide, young man, is the glass of the lens harder or softer than diamond? The young man said he didn't know, at which point she whips her diamond ring off and scratches a big gouge in the glass. And ever since then, we no longer let people to look at the telescope. Well, that's goofy for many reasons. That never happened.
That whole thing was a fabrication?
Yes, although it is absolutely true that Charles Tyson Yerkes requested that the telescope never show the lens end to the public. This is from your cat.
It is in fact from my cat, who kisses my nose every time.
Every time I read that.
Yerkes Starquest is on. Yep.
Yep. The cat recognizes your voice. I read that on Facebook today.
Just today, you read Facebook. That's fascinating.
I hate Facebook. It keeps me from writing my book about the architectural detail of Yerkes Observatory.
Well, that's an interesting point. I understand you have a book about the architectural detail of Yerkes. Now, well, as we talked, you were starting it. How you coming?
I'm about halfway done, and it's been beset by technical problems. Not who will publish such a missive, but rather, how do you get the photos to keep from disintegrating? I am in the process of working with a noteworthy architect, in fact, who's local, and he's made extremely helpful comments. So we're working on it. I hope to be published, unbeknownst to them, by the University of Wisconsin Press, as they have many volumes written on interesting locations. I think it'll be a nice fit.
I understand from Mr. K that we may be a lot closer to the mystery of the figures on the outdoor columns as you enter than we were before, that they were found in a common book for the time, that they may not be unique. Does this strike a bell at all, that we may be able to discern?
Dan Kaler actually told me that there were a couple of books that all the architects used to use from that time period. He said he had one. I purchased the other, and I'm not wholly convinced. But I do tell the public there's probably nothing special about most of the architectural detail. It doesn't mean anything. It's just there.
Are we ever going to find, using some kind of radar X-ray, there's got to be three or four of the hornets left.
Oh.
Hidden. And couldn't one use imaging to...
No, yes, it's called photography. You take your picture dated 1899 and you enlarge it. And there you have the bee back. I also have a modern picture taken with the fellow with a long nose, John D. Rockefeller of Standard Oil fame. Mm-hmm. And the picture was taken in 1899. The hornets or bees were chiseled off in 1901. But I took a nice, sharp picture recently, 3 years ago, and using Photoshop, put the bee back on the nose. But you can see where the bee used to be just by walking up to the column. It looks like something was scraped off. Hmm. But no, glad you asked, Jim. The most astonishing new discovery I made was finding a picture of the architect Henry Ives Cobb, whose face looks much more like the smiling, jovial face underneath the man with the big nose in profile than does the person we thought it was. We thought it was Wayne Rainey Harper, but no, it's Henry Ives Cobb. He threw himself into his work.
How certain are you on that?
100%. It looks vaguely like Henry Ives Cobb. I'll show you the picture, and you can be the judge.
That's huge. That's a story in himself. Has he ever done that? Well, he did. He had a signature on this building in another way, doesn't he?
Well, Henry Ives Cobb has a brick with his name in it, inscribed in it. But I think you're referring to one of the two shields underneath winged lions that are in repose. That means they're not on their haunches. They're lying down. One of the shields seems to have Henry Ives Cobb's initials. And the other has two pair of drawing compasses, a T-square and a right triangle, which I'd like to remind all of you is nothing at all like one pair of drawing compasses, a capital G that stands for who knows what, and a circle square. Now that is a Freemason symbol. Yeah. This other thing could be Henry Ives Cobb's little joke. It could mean Masons know what he's talking about, but I've never seen a Freemason, and I've met a half a dozen of them here. Never seen one look at it and go, oh, or smile or nod or anything. They appear to be actually baffled, as I am.
And often befuddled, as you've been known to be on occasion.
Bewitched, bewildered, and bewildered.
How was his name on a brick? Was it inscribed? Was it painted?
It's something you can actually see. It's inscribed. It's chiseled out, Henry Ives Cobb. Remarkably, it's on the south entrance. I'm sorry. It's on the north entrance, which was more or less the back door. When this place was built, they used the south entrance. It's prettier. It's more sunny. The road used to go all the way around. These days, people go in what used to be the back entrance. It's now the front entrance by all those parking lot spaces.
Huh. Last area of inquiry for this time.
A likely story.
Deer? You want to talk about the deer?
Yes, sweetie.
Is this a good time?
Yes. People have called our deer and other deer rats with antlers. But we love our deer. We think they're sweet. I actually got close to a fawn 2 years ago simply by making strange noises. The fawn started to approach me, looked at me, started to approach me. And then I saw Mom a little farther away, and I suddenly realized how sharp that a deer's hooves, whatever they are, can be. And I changed my mind and slowly walked away before Mom could attack. I was between, the fawn was between me and Mom. Kids, never go up to a strange deer or bear.
But if you're coming here for a night viewing, it's very likely, especially around sundown, that you're going to run into deer.
Well, we hope you don't physically run into them, but you should slow down because it's dark. And the deer are rather tame around here.
Have you figured out where they live? Do they live on the property or nearby?
They live all around the woods here, and the woods, when you cross the street, continue very close to my house. So I'm convinced, having seen certain deer that are recognizable, that they're the same deer, and they just float around all over Williams Bay, as do now wild turkeys. We see a lot more wild in the way of wild turkeys than we did, say, in 1980 when I first came here.
And wow, and not the kind of wild turkey that comes in a bottle.
Not that kind. These are the kind turkeys which rhyme with yerkes. Good way to remember how to pronounce it.
I should ask you too, although I rarely use my quotes in any of this. For the better part of a year and a half, no, 2 years, for the better part of 2 years, you, sir, have been the daytime go-to guy, haven't you, for tours? Are you kind of on the alert five, as we say in the Navy?
I wouldn't know about this alert five. I thought you were a Marine.
I was a Marine first and then a sailor.
Well, all right.
Yeah.
Okay. Turns out that I am the only weekday tour person, almost 99% of the time, maybe more. So if you were to come here Monday through Friday, any day but Christmas, New Year's, and Thanksgiving, if Christmas and New Year's fall on a weekday, which they do now and again, if you happen to do that, this time of year we have tours beginning at 11. And again, at 2 p.m., you just need to show up. Be sure to ring the doorbell. Don't stand around waiting for people to come. Ring the doorbell. And for $10 per person and $8 per child under the age of 17 or under, we will give you about a 45-minute to one-hour tour, which is more intimate than the Saturday tours, which at this time I'm also doing, which is why I'm sounding so hoarse. But when I retire in 106 days, but who's counting, I'll be working half-time only. I'll still be probably doing 2 to 3 tours a day, which would be interesting.
That's Community Matters for this week. I'm Jim McClure. You have a great day and a blessed week ahead.
You've been listening to Community Matters, a program that airs every Saturday morning at 11:15 on WGTD. For an online recording of today's show, log on to WGTD's website at WGTD.org, click Talk, and go to Community Matters. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.